Often what they are looking to do is to target, incentivize, or reward specific heightened environmental outcomes.
It's about how the banks and other financial institutions are just changing the way that they're deciding who to lend to and how they're lending money. They are looking at those sort of factors like the environment and social impact, good governance, you know, we know them as the ESG factors. Producers with stronger ESG profiles may benefit from favourable financing conditions, and while those that might not be at that sort of strong stage yet probably need to consider what that's going to look like for them in terms of cost of capital.
AgriFutures Australia acknowledges the First Nations people as the traditional custodians of the lands and waters of which we live, learn and work. We pay our respects to past, present and future elders of these nations. This is AgriFutures On Air, brought to you by AgriFutures Australia, driving innovation in Australian agriculture.
Hello and welcome. My name is Georgia Pugh and you are listening to a special podcast series on AgriFutures On Air on sustainable finance. I'm joined today by Emma Harbison from AgriFutures Australia and Emma Hurd from Ernst & Young. Welcome, ladies.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Georgia, for having us.
No worries. It's great to have you both with us. Emma Harbison, we might kick things off with you. Would you mind telling us a bit about yourself and the work AgriFutures Australia has been doing with regards to sustainable finance?
Yeah, no worries. Thanks, Georgia. So Emma Harbison, I am a program manager within the Rural Futures team here at AgriFutures Australia. And in my role, I manage and focus on some projects around proactively addressing some core industry challenges and opportunities across the Australian ag, fish and forestry sector. So today we're here talking with Emma Hurd from Ernst & Young around a project that we're doing, which builds upon the project that we did with KPMG in 2022 around banking on sustainability. We saw that there was a need to do an updated scan on the environmental social lending landscape and the products that were available, as well as doing a bit of a deep dive into the costs and benefits associated with sustainable financing.
Thank you very much, Emma Harbison. Emma Hurd, we might go to you now. Would you mind telling us a bit about your role at Ernst & Young and the project that you've been involved with on sustainable finance?
Yeah, thanks, Georgia, and pleasure to be with you here today. So I'm Emma Hurd, good to be on a podcast with two Emmas, and I'm a partner in the EY Climate Change and Sustainability Services practice, and I'm also the co-lead of the EY Net Zero Centre, which is a firm-wide kind of strategic initiative that EY set up just to deal with what we're seeing with the really complex and emerging decarbonisation and particularly climate challenges that a lot of our clients are facing right across the economy in every industry sector and public and private sector as well. Most of the work that I do is across sustainable finance or sustainability reporting or climate related work in particular. And in working with AgriFutures, I think a lot of that kind of came to play in this project where we're looking to understand what's happening at the farm level, what's happening in the climate science, what's happening with regulations responding to climate, and then in particular what the finance sector is doing, which provides some opportunities for producers to access new products, new services as well. So we really worked with other Emma and the team just to kind of like take out some of that noise in terms of what we're hearing with sustainable finance and really drill down into what does this mean? If you're a producer, how can you get involved? What should you be aware of as well? So that's kind of where I came into play as well.
And Emma, how long have you been doing this work in sustainable finance at Ernst & Young?
Yeah, so this project is almost at completion. It's been happening for probably since the start of the year now, which is pretty exciting. We've done a lot in this space recently. As I mentioned, the Banking on Sustainability report that KPMG did for us, that was in 2022. So this is not a new topic area to us. This is something that we've been working on and trying to, as Emma Hurd said, you know, digest for the Australian producer for a few years now. And what we're seeing is that it is evolving and changing quite quickly. So the need to sort of be on the front foot and be proactive in digesting the landscape is really important.
And that proactivity, I suppose, has been driven by the need for producers to have an awareness of it and be able to act on it if they want to choose to.
Yeah, exactly. The awareness piece, I think, is key. I don't think that there is enough awareness around what's available at the moment. And as new products come into the market, I think we need to continue to build that awareness piece and sort of help producers along the journey to know how and what they can access at what points in time and for what, you know.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Emma Harbison. Emma Hearn, now what actually is sustainable finance and what does it mean for Australian producers? Can you please shed some light for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, sustainable finance is a term which is increasingly being used to describe the kind of a basket of different sorts of products and services that the finance sector is increasingly developing to help incentivize more sustainable outcomes. So in a nutshell, it's effectively finance for the purposes of promoting more sustainable outcomes, or for short, sustainable finance. Really what it's aiming to do is probably focusing predominantly on environmental issues at the moment, although there are also social dimensions to it in terms of thinking through how to have positive community or social impacts. But most of the products and the services that we've seen to date are focused on the environment side of sustainability as well. Often what they are looking to do is to target, incentivize, or reward specific heightened environmental outcomes. So activities that you take which deliver energy efficiency or water consumption improvements or better land management practices or better, in particular, better climate-related outcomes, so reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. It's really around kind of showing that dollars lent to a particular company or farmer or producer are delivering measurable outcomes against those sorts of goals. Globally, we've seen a whole range of standards and frameworks that have, you know, been implemented and designed that the market has adopted, which provide standardization around how you measure that. So how do you set your baseline? What are the eligible activities? How do you measure the outcomes in order to ensure that we don't have greenwashing across the sector and that you get some standardization from a sector perspective around how to actually achieve it? So that's all in the detail, but really I think what it comes down to in terms of what is sustainable finance, it's finance to try and achieve more sustainable outcomes as measured and assessed against a range of standards and frameworks, which are all kind of clustered under the heading of sustainable finance.
Emma Harbison, is there anything else you'd like to add about sustainable finance and what it means to producers?
No, look, I think Emma Hurd has summed it up really well. I think in a nutshell for producers, it's about how the banks and other financial institutions are just changing the way that they're, you know, deciding who to lend to and how they're lending money. They are looking at those sort of factors like the environment and social impact, good governance. You know, we know them as the ESG factors. But yeah, I would just echo what Emma Hurd said around that.
Now, Emma Hurd, we might go back to you. Who can actually access these sustainable finance products? Is it particular types of farms, particular size businesses? And how do producers actually go about accessing these sustainable finance products?
Yeah, there's probably a range of different types of ways in which you can engage with your bank or other parts of the finance sector around sustainable finance products. So very much that what we tend to see is that there are some products which are sort of similar to an agribusiness loan or an agri loan, but they have specific activity, which if you are undertaking those activities, it means you're eligible for a particular set of conditions or set of incentives or discounts on your interest rate returns, for example. So if you're doing one of the things that are listed in their particular, you know, green agri product, then you can access it for the purposes of borrowing money to undertake that activity. There's others which are much more kind of focused on whole of farm performance outcomes. So can you measure against a baseline, say, for example, of greenhouse gas emissions on a whole of farm basis or energy consumption? And if you achieve a measurable improvement against agreed KPIs with the bank, then they'll also give you a discount on your interest rates or put in place other types of financial incentives to help reward or incentivize you spending sometimes a little bit of extra money to achieve those extra outcomes as well. So that's probably more like a labeled sustainable finance loan, it's called a sustainability linked loan, or SLL, because it's the finance sector, so it has to have an acronym. And then I think probably the third batch is where you start getting into much bigger scale enterprises, where you get into climate bonds or green bonds. And they can often be at the corporate entity level and are often kind of more around capital raising for large scale projects, pieces of equipment or production changes or process changes, which might be in the tens of millions of dollars. So really at the large end of the scale as well. So it's either an existing product which delivers sustainable outcomes for particular activities, a labeled product where it's a sustainability linked loan where you are achieving measurable outcomes, or it's a large scale capital raise or bond for a large multi-million dollar equipment shift as well. All of these things, these are the different types, but all of them sort of start with the first step, no matter how big or small you are, which is actually what is the outcome or change you are trying to achieve and how do you measure it? So depending on what kind of producer you are, that could be on-farm process changes or energy reduction changes, how are you going to measure that? and what is the quantum of change that you expect to achieve? And then what's the best way to finance it is often a function of what kind of finance do you need? Do you need to borrow money? Can you do it anyway out of your reserves? You know, who is your banker? What kinds of options are they actually providing? It's always best to have a conversation with the bank in terms of, well, I know I'm going to achieve this outcome. What kinds of products or services are you offering? And then I guess the third part is also just kind of taking into account, usually with these products, there are multi-year requirements. So are you in a position to ensure compliance with the specific requirements of the product? Whether that's demonstrating you've implemented the equipment, demonstrating you've achieved those targets over a multi-year period, demonstrating that you can continue to show compliance with the requirements of the loan product or the bonds product as well. So very much kind of bearing in mind, what's your starting point? What are you trying to achieve? What's your bank doing that they can offer you? And then thirdly, have you put in place the considerations for year-on-year requirements that might be part of compliance for the product as well? That's probably a little bit of a snapshot in terms of what that looks like. And then in the report, we've gone into a lot more detail about how that translates to different types of producers and different types of products to deep dive into a bit more detail around that kind of the what, the how, and the how do you ensure compliance.
That's good to know. Thank you, Emma Hurd. Emma Harbison, now, what industries are you seeing as being affected by sustainable finance or being able to access sustainable finance? Can anyone from any agriculture industry access it?
Yeah, look, I definitely wouldn't say that it's affecting or impacting particular industries industries in particular. What I would say that, you know, whilst producers can access these sorts of finance products through, you know, their banks, there's also other avenues around sort of agricultural cooperatives and agribusiness companies as well that play a role here in providing sustainable finance products for their members and their partners. So, and I'd also encourage people to talk to their advisors as well. They might be specialize in this area. You know, the advisors can really help producers to navigate the requirements of the sustainable finance products and help demonstrate the compliance and prepare the necessary reporting and documentation that they might require. So, I wouldn't say that it's affecting anyone. I think it's open to anyone who is able to tick those sort of boxes for the products as well.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, Emma Hurd, the report that you've been working on, can you please tell us a bit more about it and some of the key takeaways that you've learnt that would help producers?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably where we started was looking to really do that update on everything that's changed in the last 2 years around how much activity there is in sustainable finance. And we do that, and we do also go through and look at product types and the increasing and expanding way in which they're being applied for different types of activities and across different parts of the ag sector as well. So we do definitely do all that. But I think probably the other interesting part of the report is the summarizing just how much is going on in the broader regulatory landscape and the value chain that producers are facing, which is also creating that incentive to think about engaging in sustainable finance opportunities as well. So both in Australia, but also in terms of some of our key export markets, we're seeing a lot of environmental and social and governance regulation coming through. That's actually impacting the operating environment and the demands and the expectations for producers to do a lot more data gathering and measurement. And that compliance demand is also creating opportunity to use that data and use those measurement requirements to actually better engage with sustainable finance products as well. So there's a lot going on around the regulatory landscape. And in particular within Australia, coming in on the 1st of January 2025 is the mandatory climate change reporting for large entities. And we fully expect that will continue to flow through large companies' supply chains and value chains, and will continue to impact producers in terms of that expectation to be able to show what they're doing on environmental performance in particular. So a lot going on in reg. The second thing that we found, which I think was really interesting, is that there's a clear market driver here as well. So there's the regulatory and the compliance driver, but also from a market perspective, there's opportunities to access the value chains of overseas customers in particular, where you can differentiate and get into the supply chain of some really large companies on the basis of being able to show your environmental performance and your sustainability performance as well. So it's not just that there's the compliance demand, but there's also the market opportunity to crack new markets and potentially get new customers for your goods and services as well, in terms of how they are responding to this broader sustainability drive as well. So we started off looking at products and services and what's changed in sustainable finance. And what we actually found is the whole market is changing and increasingly looking at sustainability. And finance is a way to enable producers to potentially respond better to these risks and opportunities, as well as an increasing opportunity in and of itself to access discounted financial products and services as well.
That's great. Thank you. Emma Harbison, what do these increasing regulations around ESG actually mean for producers? What sort of reporting and flow-on effects will this have for those larger companies up the supply chain, do you think?
Yeah, look, I think producers should be obviously aware of the ESG regulations and standards and the reporting requirements that are associated with them, definitely. I think most Australian financial institutions are voluntary reporting. They've started to voluntarily report on the climate issues. And as Emma Heard mentioned, you know, there will be mandatory reporting as of 1 January next year. And so, you know, they will need to improve their reporting around their greenhouse gas emissions, which is going to mean that, you know, that verifiable data piece from any of these businesses is going to be key. And, you know, financial institutions are expanding their public ESG commitments, which is going to include natural capital. It's going to become a really important topic. And, you know, if you look at the five largest banks that have committed to net zero emissions by 2050 or even sooner. So I think it's crucial that Australian businesses that use debt in particular understand how these commitments might impact their access to capital. And, you know, there's going to be things like more detailed data linking to the ESG performance, to financial returns as they become available. Financiers, they're better equipped to sort of interrogate these sorts of things as well, especially around credit risk for their underwriting assessments. So for Australian producers, really, it means that their sustainability efforts can or could directly influence their ability to access capital, the interest rates that they pay, and also the overall terms of their financing arrangements. So what I would say is that, you know, producers with stronger ESG profiles may benefit from favourable financing conditions. And while those that might not be at that sort of strong stage yet probably need to consider what that's going to look like for them in terms of cost of capital is probably what I'd add.
Yeah. Can I add one thing, Georgia, as well? I mean, I think it's useful to think about this. There's the three layers that impact most producers. So there's international regs are happening in key export markets, which are flowing through to us as an exporting nation, and in particular for producers that are targeting offshore markets. And that's happening everywhere. It's not just Europe. It's also happening in Asia. It's also happening in the US as well. You've also got then national regulations in Australia around increased requirements for reporting, but also the ACCC is also looking at green and consumer product labelling claims, performance claims, and standardising that as well. And then at the state level, you've also got a lot of state governments who are both setting their own targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions or responding to climate change, but also are implementing a lot of programs to support organisations to respond. And in particular, lots of grants and incentive-based programs are happening at the state level, which provide an alternative form of support or finance for some of these upfront costs that might be involved in meeting regulatory change as well. So it's definitely worth thinking about this is happening at multiple points in the governance structure of Australia and are impacting both directly and indirectly producers as to how they need to respond to these issues. But no matter what the regulation is, the number one step is know your footprint. Know your opportunities to improve your performance and think about what the costs and benefits are associated with improving your footprint and improving your measurable outcomes as well.
For those of you who are completely blown away by all the different acronyms being thrown around, you're not the only one. I just wanted to clarify that ESG actually means environmental, social and governance. Now, what are the actual market trends with sustainable finance at the moment, Emma Heard? What are the sorts of trends and key initiatives are you seeing out there at the moment in Australia?
We're seeing a lot of carbon footprinting that's happening at the product level. So are you able to show the carbon intensity of your production process or your land management process or your end product as well? So I think that carbon footprinting and then from an end product labelling perspective is important. In terms of the other forms of impacted regulation, we've also seen a lot of land management and deforestation related regulations which are flowing through to implications for on-farm land management, which are worth keeping a close eye on because they also continue to evolve. I mean, I know in Australia they've always been very top of mind, but they're continuing to evolve in particular about what we're seeing internationally. And then I think the other part that I would kind of note is that consumer product and labelling requirements as well, which is going to flow through the value chain around the sustainability credentials and performance of products. And so many producers will be an input into those end product labeling requirements as well. So just being aware that some of those product evolutions at the consumer facing side may flow through to expectations for you as a producer and being able to provide particular types of information. So that's kind of one side of the market. The other side of the market, I think, which is going back towards the sustainable finance side of the question as well, is that there's a huge amount of lingo. I'm not going to lie. There's a huge amount of lingo which is thrown around, and ESG is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the acronyms. So warning, acronyms ahead. But definitely, probably, we use sustainable finance as a descriptor of the whole lot, but probably the main ones are things like, on the banking side, asset finance, equipment finance, or lending products, which are specifically targeting the ag sector, where they either frame it around the equipment that you might need to purchase, or things like solar panels on farm, or alternative sources of energy, or energy reduction on farm if you're an energy intensive producer. There's also the carbon markets side of funding as well, in terms of dealing with intermediaries who are looking for available land in which to principally get involved in tree planting in order to be eligible for carbon credits, and then just thinking through potential additional revenue streams there. That often gets included in the sustainable finance bucket, even though it's kind of a little bit different. You also then have sustainability linked loans, which, or SLLs is the one I mentioned before, which is very much specific. Most banks now have dedicated teams, sustainable finance teams, and if you reach out to your bank or your banking relationship manager, they will often put you in contact with the key people there. Some banks are increasingly now having dedicated ag-facing sustainable finance specialists. That's the holy grail, because they understand your business and understand sustainable finance as well. And then I guess the last part is the climate bonds or sustainability-linked bonds part of the finance product. They're usually pretty large scale. They're often assessed against particular key international frameworks. So the Green Loan Principles, Sustainability Loan Principles, the Climate Bonds Initiative, for example, they're all, I can say them in the acronyms, but I'll say them in English first. They're also key standards that underpin a lot of the sustainable finance activities. So there's a long-winded answer. Apologies, Georgia, but I guess part of it is being aware of the consumer-facing side as where you sit in the value chain, and the other part is being aware of the increasing types of products that sit under the sustainable finance label, and thinking about how you, if you have to do one thing, how do you get twice as much bang for your buck in terms of accessing the opportunities in all parts as well.
Thank you for that, Emma Heard. What about the different types of sustainable finance products? I understand there's sustainable loans. Maybe one day there'll be valuations impacted by sustainable finance. Maybe sustainable finance insurance products. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's probably three ways to think about this. So the first is that when banks or lenders are making credit risk decisions, they are increasingly building sustainability or environmental provisions into their just baseline credit risk assessment. So looking at where some environmental risks might impact credit risk worthiness as well. So at the risk assessment point on any product, you may be coming up against environment, social, and governance risk frameworks and considerations. Anyway, but then secondly, it's depending on what type of product you're looking to access. There are often sustainable finance iterations or versions of it. So I mentioned before, whether it's asset finance, equipment finance, a lending or a loan product for an activity, or even a generic loan or lending product across the board, if you can show that there's a connection to sustainability performance outcomes, you can often get positive incentive-based structures built into it as well. And then on the insurance side, it's a really good question. So we probably on insurance is part of the sustainable finance world as well. But I think where we're seeing that flow through at the moment is more around the underwriting policies and how they're building it into their forward modeling around risk pricing. And I'm sure anyone who's in an area which has been exposed to increasing frequency of extreme weather, like floods, for example, will have seen that reflected in their premium pricing in recent years. But definitely, it's not so much a standalone product product, as though as much as it's an increasing factor influencing the pricing of insurance as well. And then I guess in the insurance sector, you're also seeing some products coming through again to reward or incentivize households or properties which take actions to improve their resilience to the effects of these climate events. So whether it's even things such as raising up your house a few centimeters if you can, changing land management, or thinking through other solar panels on the roof, like lots of different things that you can do. You're seeing insurance products that are also coming through which recognize that you should represent a lower risk because of the steps you've taken to improve your resilience. They're all a bit different, so definitely talk to your insurance provider or talk to a broker around where the opportunities are there as well. But yeah, risk assessment, lending products plus insurance, all looking at how do they recognize the steps that individuals or producers are taking to achieve sustainable outcomes as well.
That's great. Thanks for shedding the light on that. Natural capital is a term that a lot of producers might be hearing as well these days. Do either of you have any thoughts on how that might fit in, whether it's now or in the future, with sustainable finance?
Well, I'm happy to jump in because it's interesting because we are recording this podcast the week before the Global Nature Positive Summit, which is about to take place in Sydney. And what's really interesting about the Global Nature Positive Summit is that it is a real blend of private sector and government in terms of looking at the changing way in which we think about natural capital and nature and biodiversity system services across the natural environment as well, and how we value that and price that. So I think what we're seeing is that in the same way that we've spent the last, say, 30 years going through and looking at where emissions are and how climate will impact the economy and the country, we're now turning our minds to doing that in a much more deliberative way around nature and biodiversity, and really looking to recognize how do we value natural capital? How do we value the stocks, flows, and resources that are embedded within our land? How do we reward and value steps that are taken to preserve, protect, or regenerate natural capital as well? So a lot of the kind of same thinking that flows through the sustainable finance product world around energy and climate is increasingly now flowing over to nature and biodiversity outcomes as well. And to be really specific about what does that mean, it means things like water consumption or water efficiency, means things like air quality or your emissions, air emissions associated with activities. It's things like land use and land use change or promoting net habitat gain as well. These are all now being increasingly embedded within sustainable finance products as an extension from climate and energy to nature. This is something that producers will be more than familiar with in terms of the benefits, but I think the rest of the world is now catching up and the finance sector is catching up in terms of really looking to recognize and value actions taken to invest in natural capital.
Well, I think that'll be music to the ears of most producers, so that's great to hear. Thank you. Alrighty, Emma Hurd, what about the benefits and costs with sustainable finance for producers? Have you got any examples of the sorts of benefits for producers with sustainable finance with the products that are out there at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, definitely there's no denying the fact that there are costs associated with some of the setup and establishment actions that you need to take. So measuring your baseline and understanding what your footprint is, like, usually involves a bit of spend and time and effort in terms of putting in the work. And then often a lot of the, if it's an equipment change or a process change, often there's additional costs associated with the capital requirements for investing in new kit or new systems and processes as well. But so there's kind of like a CapEx cost. But then often what we tend to find is that the outcomes of investing in these activities is reduced ongoing operating costs. So the same like environmental KPIs such as resource efficiency, water efficiency, energy efficiency, they all lower your bills in terms of energy costs, water costs, a lot of the things which contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, the costs associated with just reducing and being more efficient in the way that you go about doing things. So often there's a bit of upfront spend, but then there's ongoing and enduring cost savings in terms of the actual achievement of the outcomes. Is probably a little bit simplistic, but that's one useful way to think about it. The only caveat I would say is that there in any of these requirements, there are ongoing measurement and monitoring obligations. So depending on the complexity of what you've done on farm or or how you're looking to demonstrate the gains, there might be some annual costs incurred associated with just being able to show and evidence and demonstrate the gains that you've got through measurement as well. But definitely it's a little bit of a spread cost profile in terms of the things you need to do, and then often that's offset by the incentives or the beneficial financial treatment that you gain on the product side as well.
And what do those incentives look like? Are they significantly lower interest rates or differences in timeframes for the repayment? Any differences in terms otherwise? How does that all work?
Yeah, it's hard to get an exact figure on the interest rate reductions because obviously it's pretty commercially sensitive around each of the banks. It tends to be like a cut off the top of the existing one, that's for sure. And an environment where any saving on interest rates is a win at the moment, I would argue that any gain is a good gain. And it very much depends on negotiations with the particular financial institution. So it can be a preferential pricing treatment of the product as a whole as a reflection of a better risk profile. It can be actually specifically linked to reduced interest rates on your repayments. And if you achieve particular KPIs, then you achieve a higher cut on your interest rates, or you get lower interest rates. I probably should have said it that way around. It can also be punitive. So if you fail or if you significantly exceed those KPIs, then you pay higher than preset interest prices as well. So that's just something to bear in mind, is that if you get it right, you get the win. If you get it wrong, then you might have that payment on the upside as well. And then I guess the other part of it is also often it's the broader favorable terms and conditions. It doesn't really reflect in the length of the loan to your question, Georgia. It's not that the tenor isn't really impacted. That tends to be pretty standard, but it's more around the terms and conditions and the pricing of the loan or the product is where you often see some of those benefits as well.
And presumably, Emma Harbison, there'd be other benefits that farmers would get from adopting some of these practices and implementing these initiatives on farm.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, aside from those financial incentives that producers can access, there is obviously that, you know, increase in productivity gains and improve farm profitability from adopting some of those practices. And, you know, simple things like understanding your number and then implementing strategies or management practices that then continue to improve that over time is not only going to allow you to access those financial incentives, but also, you know, improve your productivity gains and be able to hopefully in the future, maybe it might come down to market access as well, improve market access and those sorts of things for the products that you sell. So I think there are definitely financial incentives, but there's also productivity and profitability incentives as well.
That sounds great. I think most producers would be interested in opportunities to increase productivity and maybe lower some of those fertilizer bills. Emma Hurd, have you got any other key messages for farmers to prepare for and take action on sustainable finance?
Other key messages, I guess I would say that the market and the regulatory drivers mean that many producers are going to face increasing pressure around being able to show the sustainability performance of their practices. So it's kind of coming at producers from the market and from regulatory shifts. But I think there's also a way to think about, which is using potentially using the sustainable finance opportunities as a means to get ahead of some of these trends and to actually then begin to access some of the benefits from an on-farm productivity or cost reduction perspective that Emma Harbison was also talking about as well. So you mentioned reducing your fertilizer bills. There's also productivity gains as well, as Emma mentioned. There's also potential increased resilience to drought through different sorts of rotational grazing, for example. There's also increased water quality, increased vegetation contributing to other types of land management or soil health outcomes as well. So I guess the short answer is, if this is coming at you anyway, can you use the sustainable finance opportunities as a means to get ahead of it and reap the rewards of actually getting better on-farm practices and more sustainable outcomes as well? And then I guess the last comment I would make is that actually these actions contribute to a better living environment for all of us as well, in terms of avoiding the worst effects of climate change itself through heat and extreme weather in particular, but also in terms of improved air quality, improved water quality, improved land management as well. So there's lots of reasons to do it, and sustainable finance is a bridge to help reduce the costs of doing it as well.
Emma Harbison, have you got any other key takeaways that you'd like to add to help producers with sustainable finance in the future?
Yep. So I'd probably just add three sort of key things around key messages, but also key support for producers navigating this space. So I think the key one, if they are considering sustainable finance, would be to engage with their bank and, you know, set up that meeting to discuss whatever sustainable finance options are there, you know, clarify what their bank's expectations would be around that sort of eligibility requirements and those sorts of things, and what would be required from their point of view to meet and maintain those requirements from the product. I think the second key thing to sort of consider would be to, as Emma Heard said, you know, these things are coming. So the sooner that we can prepare and plan for these sorts of measurements and reporting, the better off that we're going to be in the long run. So whether the sustainable finance is that bridging gap to be able to then have a comprehensive measurement and reporting system built into your business, you know, engage with advisors, talk to people. I think the key thing is, you know, there are people out there that are there to support producers. There's industry groups, we've got peak bodies, we've got, you know, advisors on the ground, as well as the sort of financing sector who have, you know, specialists in sustainable finance and around the reporting things. So I think connect with your industry association, connect with your bank, you know, consider how you can align your business with these sorts of products, whether they are even the types of products that are suitable, depending on your business and what your goals are as well. But my key message would be to seek out those guidance, seek out the guidance for the unique challenges and opportunities that are available.
Thank you, Amber Harbison. Now, this is just the first episode of this special podcast series on AgriFutures On Air on sustainable finance. So we will be digging into these areas a lot more in the next three episodes of the series. So please stay tuned to keep learning more about sustainable finance. We don't want to overwhelm everyone with new concepts and initiatives. This is just an opportunity for us to all learn together, as this is such a new and a quickly evolving space. Now, finally, Emma Heard, is there anything else you'd like to add about sustainable finance? Any other final key tips or reflections to share?
Yeah, I think my last message is don't be put off by the acronyms and the terminology. Actually, when you take the lid off this, it's actually pretty familiar practices that underpin a lot of these products. So I guess my hot tip would be ignore the acronyms and the finance sector speak, and actually just look to the activities that they're asking of you and think through the broader benefits of it as well, because there is a lot there that you will be very familiar with. It's just a question of then how do you translate it into the way that the finance sector is thinking about it as well.
Emma Harbison, any other final reflections or thoughts?
Stay tuned for the rest of the podcast series and the other resources that we develop out of this project. You know, we really want to, you know, make it digestible for producers to be able to understand and digest and navigate the landscape. I think that's the key thing. Like Emma Heard said, you know, don't be put off by the acronyms. It's not over complex once you actually get into the nuts and bolts or the weeds of it, I would say. So yeah, just ask the question and start somewhere.
That's terrific advice. Thank you. I want to conclude today's session. Thank you so much, ladies, for your time today. I think we can all agree that we've all learned a bit today and there's more to learn, but we will work through the journey together and continue to evolve and understand the sustainable finance space.
This episode of AgriFutures On Air is brought to you by the National Challenges and Opportunities team at AgriFutures Australia. The National Challenges and Opportunities portfolio is responsible for engaging with key industry stakeholders on big issues such as sustainability, carbon, waste and energy, and shining a light on the opportunities they present. For more information on sustainable financing or a deeper dive into the costs and benefits for Australian producers, check out the Knowledge Hub on the AgriFutures Australia website.